Hello, my name is Julie Gamble. I'm 20 years old, and today is March 15th, 2018. I'm with
Shessa.
And your last name?
That's
okay.
Last name. My first name is S. Period.
S. Period. Who is my partner today in this interview? And we are recording this in San Francisco, California.
For StoryCorps.
For StoryCorps. Thank you.
I wrote this speech and have been delivering it to classes and colleges and universities around the city of San Francisco for the Mental Health Association of San Francisco. It's called Recovering from Finders and Keepers Addiction, and I'm reading this because it gives a good sketch of my overall life. Hi, I'm Shessa, and I'm a collector. Hands up, you collectors. Ever been called a hoarder or clutterer? Been called crazy? Ooh, now that's stigma for you. I've been diagnosed with PTSD, depression, anxiety, schizoaffective, and autism intermittently by the pros. But I narrow it down to finders and keepers addiction, since that's the condition that's caused me the most worry and stigma, as well as being my greatest challenge to living independently. It's a tale to tell. I grew up sharing a chest of four drawers with three younger sisters who'd go rifling through my belongings till everything got heaped on top. Stuff just disappeared. So, for instance, I didn't get to play with the few dolls I had till they were gone. Whereas other kids were mommy's little helpers, I was mommy's little absent-minded professor. I started my first year of school with a public spanking, with my mom's okay, and with my skirt up, for forgetting my homework. Meanwhile, my dad used my head to bash holes in the walls. Now that was stigma. So I was off and running, with guilt aplenty, and my skills were lagging. In my 60s, mid-teens, my parents encouraged me to become addicted to the James Bond books, which I forced myself to get rid of when my family sailed to Hawaii. I figured in the long run, the books were more depressing than I was already depressed. Now, that realization was recovery, and it was around then that I started practicing body-mind self-hypnosis. Through this healing journey, although exposure to Eastern cultures as well as a short stint as an Air Force cadet officer gave me an appreciation for simplicity as a way of life, these influences also whet my appetite to collect. For example, a neighbor of Hawaiian heritage saved my life when she gave me her seashell collection, with which I decorated a mirror to ship back to my grandmother. Now that was not only healing art, that was aloha. However, I was to drag the remainder of that collection around state to state for decades to come. By my mid-20s, my taste for the exotic found me in San Francisco to partake of the independent film and gender movements well underway in the 70s here in San Francisco, where I made a few films and did some art, poetry, and photo shows. I lived in a loft I'd built, hidden 15 feet high, among drapings of sea nets, silk saris, Swiss dotteds, and laces above my massage table, from which my ladies gazed up through global kaleidoscopes of glowing painted parasols and fans. What could be more healing? Well, what did turn out to be more healing was a march I did across the continent from LA to New York to DC in 1986 on the Pro-Peace Great Peace March for Global Nuclear Disarmament. Now that was big medicine, as Native Americans put it. You'd think that having this limitation of a bad back, living out of two crates, and of camping out nights in a dome tent would compel me to curtail my collecting for the 9-month expedition. But no, survival rigor kept gear on my mind continually. I kept upgrading gear along the way and sending replaced stuff back home. For instance, a pair of yellow and black cleated golf shoes only lasted through Death Valley before they were shipped off. After the march, I returned to box loads and expedition packs full of gear and clothes to weed through. When I sailed in a luxury liner around the Hawaiians as ship's gym manager, the entire upper half of my bunk was filled with my Hawaiian treasures. After this decade of bliss came time to move, then move, then move, a total of 10 moves in as many years. I was not only paying for my apartments, but I was also paying for a medium-large storage unit full of who knew what, months into years, while teetering on the edge of homelessness for a decade of terror. Anytime a landlady raised the issue of furniture and garden props, I'd literally broken my hips pulling out of sidewalk heaps. I'd privately sulk about middle-class people's stigma against a poor single woman's daring to be an artist, a gardener, and a collector of a wardrobe for this would-be actress model. Thus, I continued to excuse my collecting. Finally, it all just spun out of control when I moved to the federal housing I'm in now. I brought all my storage and belongings together into this medium-sized studio. Then soon after my hip replacement surgeries and my manager's giving me notice because of his stigma against my boxes being stacked wall to wall, ceiling high, I had to contend with a bed bug epidemic in the building. Well, I just flipped and committed myself to a hospital just so I could get decontaminated. But the doctors claimed I was imagining things. Now that was stigma. Meanwhile, nobody really knew anything about the creepy blood-sucking phantoms. What finally saved my sanity and my home were two heroines, my baby sister, May Breeze, an MSSW, CSW, she made me add those letters, and an old college mate of mine, Pam Mausner, MD, who sent me giant science journal clippings about the critters. As for my sanity, long-term biweekly co-counseling with my sister, along with therapy with a psychiatrist, got me out of a cycle of hospitalizations and onto a regimen of meds that's given me control over the severe trauma that technical homelessness had re-triggered for so long. Now we're talking recovery. To polish it off, I've chosen for my healing retirement a full-time array of city safety net and seniors services, practicing laughter yoga, watching films, taking long walk and talks, doing Hawaiian Pilates and Tai Chi stretching exercises. Aloha e mahalo nui.
Thank you very much for sharing that. You are very well read, your reading.
Well, thank you, Julie. You really got to the heart of matters with me previous to our coming in here to do this recording. And if you could just help me touch back on some of that, that would probably take up the rest of our time.
Absolutely. So you were, part of what you were telling me is your move to San Francisco and how you came to be. So part of what you were telling me was your move to San Francisco and how you came to be here.
I had lived in Hawaii in my teens, and my
and then you moved to, you know, you lived in Washington, D.C. for a time.
Well, I was born in Washington, D.C., and I was born in my grandmother's hospital. She was a healing woman, a Western healing woman. She had studied, been raised and studied with Native Americans. And oddly enough, that was her place of death as well, because she was hit by a car driven by a drunken ambassador at one point. And she had hundreds of people come to her funeral. So I always had her example in terms of healing intent in life. And
that was the 5 minutes.
I know.
Yeah, it's quick.
So that's
sure. Would you like to talk about how you came into your identity
As a non-binary person?
Yes.
I met my first girlfriend when I was living in Hawaii, and she was in practice. She was an Asian gal, and I don't know if that had to do with some cultural proclivity to putting her hand on my arm, but all it took was one touch, and I knew I wasn't just one gender. I knew that I must be non-binary. Of course, I didn't know the terminology by non-binary until a couple years ago. So anyway, I yeah, when I was in the military, I was attracted to women. I wasn't that attracted to men. I liked men, but I loved women, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the case until I came out with a gal. And then I saw the movie The Conformist, and that really set my mind to where I was socially. And then I met a gal who was an artist who took photographs of me, and she and I lived together for a while, and I shared with her a fantasy of what it might be like to have a penis and to be able to please a woman that way with a penis. And I think without knowing it, that is where I consciously became non-binary. And also working as a ladies massage therapist helped me realize my identity. Once a lady asked me if I would like to come to her ranch and meet her fillies, and I didn't know if she was serious or not. She was teasing me or something, but it gave me a hot flash there for a second. And now I kind of laugh about it. I don't know if she, I'll never know if she was serious or not when she said that. Mm-hmm. But it definitely put me in a context, a cultural context.
And so how, we have 1 minute left, so wrapping it up. How do you see yourself now and your identities, and how is that?
Well, a friend of mine summed it up well about herself, and I share the sentiment that my gender is according to who I happen to be standing beside and the context within which I'm standing at the time.
And that's how you see yourself?
Yeah, I am more attracted to women. I'm not attracted to men physically, nor the men I've met so far, physically nor intellectually, because I find men less inclusive than women. But I have yet to meet the right Ms. Or Mister in the world.
Would you like to end there?
Yeah, that'd be fine.
All right. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.